online, on smart speakers, and on Listen Again. This is Food FM.
The Drinking Hour with David Kermode in partnership with Club Onologique. The world through the lens of wine and spirits.
This week, Eduardo Chadwick. 20 years after he took the gamble of his life with the Berlin tasting, pitting his wines against the best in the world, perceptions have changed. We'll talk about the anniversary, what inspired him to take the risk, what's happened since, and what's next for the wines of Chile. It is two decades since Eduardo Chadwick took the risk of his life and set out to prove the wines that his family had been producing in Chile for decades could rival the best in the world. Early in 2004, he enlisted the services of the late Stephen Spurrier, architect of the famous Judgment of Paris some 30 years earlier, to put together a blind comparative tasting, pitting the Chadwick wines, including those from Senia, a partnership with Robert Mondavi, against first growths from Bordeaux and some super Tuscans too. The results of the Berlin tasting were a resounding success. Not only did Eduardo's wines take the top spots with 2000 Viñedo Chadwick and 2001 Senia ahead of 2000 Chateau Lafite and 2001 Chateau Margaux, but the longer-term strategic goal was realized as the tastings were repeated in wine capitals around the world and perceptions of Chilean wine changed. He had put his country on the global fine wine map. Well, he's celebrating 20 years on while continuing to innovate in a country that is becoming so much more exciting for wine at the moment. Eduardo joins us now. Eduardo, welcome to the Drinking Hour.
Thank you, David. A great pleasure to see you again.
Yes, and a great pleasure to chat to you again as well. Before we talk about the anniversary of the Berlin tasting, 20 years ago, it's worth taking a little step back in history because your estate is so rich in history, to the origins of the winery and the founder, whose name will be familiar to fans of your wines, Don Maximiano Errázuriz.
He was the forefather. He was the man that really created the winery. He was a very special man. He was a leading personality in the political atmosphere in Chile at the time. He was also brought several innovations, as was the man that brought the first light into Valparaíso, into the city. He was in the Senate. He was a foreign exchequer. So, and at the end of his life, he, when he was around 40s, he created Viña Errázuriz in the Aconcagua Valley. This is a beautiful property, 100 kilometers north of Santiago. And I say he was a leader because most other Chileans developed their wineries around Santiago, the capital, around the Maipo Valley. He was a bit more adventurous, and he took a ride on a horseback 100 kilometers north in those days when there were almost no roads here. So, and he found this beautiful place. His phrase would be from the best place, the best wine. And he really built the water canals from the Aconcagua River. It was a region that was absolutely virgin at the time, and he developed this beautiful estate.
It is beautiful. And for those people who know modern Chile and have been fortunate enough, as I have, to go there, beautiful country, Chilean history is quite, let's say, checkered, certainly in the recent past. And it's worth remarking on the political climate when you returned from studying enology in Bordeaux back in 1983, because you were under military rule. It was a very different country to what we see now, wasn't it?
It is true. It was a difficult time in history. We had the military coup. Well, first we had the Allende government, who was trying to Chile could have been the second Cuba of Latin America. That was the plan. And then we had a military coup, and then we had the military junta for 18 years, driven by Pinochet. So 1983, the wine industry was in real bad situation. The country had no exports. The wine consumption has dropped to minimum levels. So I would say half the industry was in bankrupt. And our winery was in one of those. It was in the hands of the banks. So when my father had the possibility to recover the estate, he invited me to join, but we had to really start taking away the spider webs. It was really a 100-year-old winery with no equipment, the best equipment we had was a cooling hose that we could put the wine into the water canaletta, into the water place to refrigerate the temperature. So it was really very, very basic. And I would say the whole of Chile was just emerging from this almost civil war and starting to doing exports.
Yes, it's astonishing that you and your family have achieved what you have in what is, in the grand scheme of things, a relatively short space of time. So take us back 20 years and tell us about the Berlin tasting in 2004 and why you felt that needed to happen.
Well, perhaps let me take you briefly 40 years back, because the first challenge was to really upgrade the winery, develop new vineyards. And that was the purpose of going to Bordeaux to learn more about winemaking, and then coming back, forming a team to expand our vineyards within the Aconcagua Valley and to bring state-of-the-art equipment, technology. And then for the next 20 years, from 1980 to year 2000, I felt we had done significant stride in the quality of our wines. I felt we were producing wines that had world-class quality, but the difficulty was getting a recognition, because very few critics came to Chile, and Chile was dominated by more good, quaffable wines that were cheap. And so people thought that Chile could just offer wines for daily drinking, but it was not really producing really terroir wines. So it was very frustrating, because we are a small family winery, and the image of Chile was not really recognized. I mean, no one thought that Chile could produce world-class wines, and that was my vision, my purpose, my objective. So it was very frustrating, because we were denied. I mean, when I traveled around the world and I would present my wines, people loved them, but then at the end would ask me, Eduardo, Mr. Charlie, what is your Parker rating? And we didn't have any. We were not part of the Robert Parker rating club. I mean, we're not. So it was embarrassing to be left out of the fine wine club. And that was the reason, the frustration that led me to organize a blind tasting in which we could compare our wines with the best of the world, with best of Bordeaux, the best of Tuscany, the Cabernet-based wines. So this tasting started with a masterclass comparing terroir, climate, etc., and then inviting the audience to the tasting. And I had all my fingers crossed that we could have perhaps one of our wines in the top five to claim we are world class. But destiny was a bit more generous. And we came first and second. And third came Lafite 2000, that had been rated 100 points by Parker. And the perception changed forever. In terms of understanding or realizing the world critics from Europe, that we were the underdog, the black horse, but our wives had the quality. So it was an amazing moment at the time.
I'm sure. And it's worth mentioning at this point, your good friend, the late Stephen Spurrier, because there's this sense in the wine world, such is the affection that is held for him, that in a sense, all roads lead to Stephen Spurrier. But the judgment of Paris back in the 1970s was a seminal moment. You were seeking to emulate that in your own way. And Stephen Spurrier was a very key part of it, wasn't he?
Absolutely. I have the greatest respect, admiration, and over the years, a friendship with Stephen. But to be very blunt with you, when we invited Stephen, it was, we never thought that this would happen. So it was not really to replicate the Judgment of Paris. This was a real destiny bonus. When I invited him, it was because he was the most knowledgeable and respected person in the UK wine market. So I felt that if we were to compare our wines in such a benchmark, having a personality of the stature of Stephen would give credibility to whatever result we had. And in reality, when we invited him, it is, let me tell you that he didn't know what was going to happen at all. And he came together with Bella, his wife, to this tasting, first thinking that he was going to be in the panel, I mean, a taster. When he arrived in Berlin, I told him, no, you should run it. And then that happened. But it was really a coincidental issue because I, being a small producer from Chile, I at the beginning, I mean, I knew him and he was the most respected man. What happened really changed our relationship. And then he was very generous to come along with me to the rest of the world because we felt that this tasting was an amazing platform to showcase the quality of our wines around the world. And I think the first tasting was the most important, was the seminal. But then it was equally important that for the next 10 years, we traveled around the world with Stephen to Tokyo, London, New York, Beijing, Sao Paulo, and the results were very similar. We always had one of our wines in the top three, and we had more than 90% of the times sort of the preference. So it was really that persistent and consecutive preference over the years that really changed the deeper the perception of fine Chilean wines around the world.
Yes, and it's worth pointing out at this point that you took a huge gamble here because you had no way of controlling these European critics in Berlin or indeed anywhere else. You chose very good vintages of the rival wines. It might have been tempting to choose a Duff year from Bordeaux or something, but you didn't. So you took a real risk.
Well, the key was to be honest, at the beginning, I was risking nothing on the first tasting because we didn't have any recognition. So that's why we wanted to really benchmark with the very best. After the results of Berlin, the big gamble or the big risk was doing the second one. And that I was very, very nervous because if the results would have been very different, it could have played back on the results of the original Berlin tasting. And it happened in Sao Paulo. And we were totally different palates. And of course, if I had never tasted these wines before in Berlin or in Savoy, and it was irrelevant because I didn't vote, of course, but also it was the audience palate and decision that made the final result. And in Sao Paulo, in first place came Margaux 2001, but then in second place came Viñedo Chadwick and third place Seña, confirming the original results in Berlin. And then when the next journey was to Tokyo in Japan, first came Latour, but second came Seña and third Viñedo Chadwick. So the results were very consistent around the world. And that was what really made a major point.
Do you think it was important that the wines were tasted and judged blind?
Absolutely. That was the key. Because Chile had this bias against when people saw that it was a Chilean label, immediately they didn't believe that the wine could be of that top quality around the world. So the key was having a blind tasting where people could just concentrate on the senses and evaluate the wine for what they were and the quality. So it was really a seminal point and a learning experience, a learning for all the critics we reached around the world. We reached more than 1,800 critics if we take the 22 tastings we did over the 10 years around the world.
And tell us about the reaction of those people in the room who are just judged blind, not just in Berlin, but elsewhere where you replicated this process. What was the reaction of some of those who may have, up to that point, been somewhat dismissive of Chilean wine?
I mean, it was very positive because one thing is the collective result, adding all the preferences, the ratings from the audience that attended the tasting, but also everyone had his own record. So if you have a blind tasting and you rate the wine for yourself, then it's not someone else giving you advice or telling him how good the wines are. It's your palate, your senses. So I think it really changed the perception of the people that attended, because they, for the first time, were confronted to really analyzing the quality of the wines by their senses, their personal senses. So we always said to the audience, you rate the wine according to your preferences. And that's a very personal choice. So, and we also choose the best vintages, because that was really very key, to have impeccable conditions. We always selected the best vintages from Bordeaux. We didn't want anyone to say, Mr. Chow, you're choosing the weak vintages. No, it was totally the opposite. We chose first vintage 2000, which was the millennial vintage that had been ranked 100 points by Parker. And then when we moved on to the next series of tastings, we moved by 2010, we moved to the 2005 vintage, which after 2000 was considered the second best vintage of that decade. So it was always impeccable conditions, trying to provide a real professional platform for the evaluation of our wines.
And the Berlin tasting, as you said, was born of this feeling that the critics weren't engaging, they weren't recognizing the quality of the wine that you had in Chile. 20 years on, is that still an issue, or has everything changed?
We have significantly changed the perception. To start, our wines are currently sold in La Place de Bordeaux. In fact, we entered La Place in 2010. And at the beginning, there was no recognition in La Place. There was no Chilean wine there, equally with the fine wine merchants in the UK. When I first met them and I talked about our wines, they had no, Chile didn't exist in their portfolio. And then I invited them to come to Chile, and they tasted the wines. And then since then, today we are being traded yearly. I mean, every year we launch the wines in our September campaign. And the market, as you know, La Place is demand and offer. So it's a very open, transparent market. And the wines are being traded and are being very successful. So we've been continually growing the recognition for our wines internationally. And so, in fact, this year, which is the 20th anniversary of the original Berlin tasting in 2004, we are celebrating. We're celebrating the recognition. And it's no longer the challenge to prove. The proof was done 10 years ago. And then the other significant proof was to do vertical tastings showing the ageability of our wines. And that was something we did in several of the tastings, comparing different vintages of the wines with their equivalent vintages from Bordeaux. And equally, the result was really very surprising. We were always coming in the top positions. We did this vertical tasting, particularly with the Seña wine, using vintages from 95 through 2010.
Well, it was a pleasure to attend that vertical tasting to celebrate the anniversary of the Berlin tasting in London. How has the reaction been to those vertical tastings?
It has been even stronger than to the original Berlin tasting, but in some markets, particularly London, for example, where the level of recognition, even in a blind tasting, given the number of masters of wine and top critics that we have in London, I think the first tasting, even though it was blind, most people were trying to identify origin, where the wine was Chilean or was Bordeaux or was Tuscany. In the second tasting, we did the vertical tasting to showcase ageability, where in which we had 20-year-old wines. The possibility to identify origin was much more difficult. And I think that was the case why Seigne came atop. The first two vintages of Seigne came atop in London and in many other places, because people were no longer able to recognize origin, and they had just to go for the quality of the wines. And surprisingly, Seigne 2008 was the wine that came atop in the London tasting with all the masters of wine and key critics of the world. And this happened in 10 tastings we did around the world for Seigne. Seigne came always atop.
That's interesting. And this process has been repeated again around the world, I think, in some key wine capitals. And again, you're getting a consistent sense of feedback, are you?
Absolutely. We did 10 tastings around the world of the vertical Seigne tastings. And in the 10 tastings, Seigne came atop. So it's even more surprising. It was really 10 out of 10.
Yeah.
It's embarrassing, but it's true. It's the reality. And also the fact that, and the person, I mean, we traveled with Stephen Sparrier around the world for 10 years. And then when we went to Asia, and I had to prove this ageability, it was Ginny Choli, the first Asian master of wine, who took the mantle. And she organized this tasting for me in Hong Kong, and then in Taiwan, in Korea, and elsewhere in Asia. And again, there was no expectation that a Chilean wine could age as well as the best wines, the Grand Cru wines of Bordeaux. But we proved it.
Yeah, well, congratulations on that, as well as the anniversary. Let's take a bigger picture look at Chile. For those less familiar with the detail of the wine map of Chile, and of course the country is famously long and thin and hugely diverse, therefore, in terms of climate conditions. Give us a snapshot, if you would, of what defines the main wine regions.
Well, Chile, as you mentioned, is a very long and narrow country, 4,300 kilometers from the north, from the Atacama Desert to the Antarctic, to the fjords in Punta Arenas. And very, very thin, only 160 kilometers as an average width, top on the east side with the Aconcagua, with the Andes range of mountains, topped by the Aconcagua mountain at 6,970 meters, so the highest of the Western Hemisphere. And then to the west, you have the Pacific Ocean with a cold, humble current that comes from Antarctica at 12 degrees. So it's very extreme. You have cold sea, the breeze coming from the seaside, and then in a very, just 180 kilometers in the mountains, you have the Aconcagua Peak. And that's where the Aconcagua Valley lies. So it's a really beautiful scenario and great conditions for grape growing. I would say that the three regions that have been known for producing top Bordeaux blends are the Aconcagua Valley, where we have Seigne on the coastal plains, and Don Maximiano more inland, at 70 kilometers inland from the sea. Then you have the Maipo Valley, which is a historical cradle for the finest Cabernet Sauvignon, where we have Viñedo Chadwick. And then also you have Colchagua, 200 kilometers south from Santiago. These are the three key regions known for Bordeaux blends. But also you have coastal valleys, or coastal plains, from the north in Elqui, Limarie, Aconcagua Costa, Casablanca, Leida, Paredones. So you have, and some new developers in the south of Chile, in Traigen and even further south. So Chile brings very nice diversity. And I think one of the things, of the key elements for the future, is developing these coastal plains where you have the right soil, the right temperatures. And we are developing, for example, a range of wines of Pinot Noir and Chardonnay in Aconcagua Costa that is also opening the eyes for many critics and consumers on fine Chardonnay and Pinot Noir from Chile.
Yes. So you're talking here about Las Pizarras.
That's right. Pisaras means slate or chist. And the particularity of this vineyard is really a soil of chist. So the roots can go deep into these layers of rock, of metamorphic rock. And then being 10, 12 kilometers from the coast, it's a very cool climate. So it's providing wines of great minerality, intensity, a very different to what was perhaps known of Chile producing more richer, riper styles of Chardonnays and Pinot Noir. This is really fine, the finest expression of Chardonnay and Pinot Noir from this valley.
Yes.
And we have just entered La Place de Bordeaux with the Las Pizarras range of wines, and it's been this year for the first time ever, and it's been very well received.
Yes, I was going to say, you're giving Burgundy a run for its money now, having given Bordeaux a run for its money, because we tasted at the event you held to mark the anniversary of the Berlin tasting at the Dorchester, we tasted Chardonnay, which is beautifully fresh and has a kind of ethereal quality to it. It's very nuanced. And last night I was fortunate enough to taste the Pinot Noir, and you've got this incredible smoothness, this velvety sense of tannins, but also this kind of purity to the fruit there, haven't you?
Absolutely, yeah. It's really it's a beautiful property. We farm it under sustainable and really holistic, regenerative farming. It's a beautiful forest. It's a large property on the hillside with forest, with flora, fauna. It's a beautiful place. It's really a very keen project, and we're very happy that we have these wines in the UK for the past 5 or so years, and they're having a very nice reception, as we tasted at the Dorchester with the Hatch Mansfield team, which are doing a great job in presenting them in the UK market.
Let's talk about your other notable wines, and you've mentioned both of them already, but let's talk about Senia first, because this is interesting. It was born of a partnership with Robert Mondavi of California fame.
Yeah. As we were talking, David, 20 years ago, or even 30 years ago, in the beginning of 1990, Chile was just beginning to export. We had the newborn democracy in 1989, the first democratic election when Pinochet left. And so 1990, Chile was just beginning to have a welcoming into the world markets. It was the regained democracy. And in 1991, we had the visit of Robert Mondavi to Chile. And I was asked to be his wine driver, or to really a wine guide. I was asked through a common friend, Cassio Rineos, to organize a week for Bob visiting the vineyards of Chile. He was curious. He had done Opus One with Baron Philippe de Rothschild, and he was curious to understand in what Chile could offer to the world. And so he came with a idea of understanding the future of Chile and eventually participating in this discovery of Chile by the world critics. And so I was very happy to take him for a week. He came with Margaret, his wife. And by the end of the journey, he told me, Eduardo, the potential you have, I see, is the potential I saw in the Napa Valley in the 1960s. And he wanted to participate in the recognition of Chile. And I was really, this was a dream project. I was marveled. I was so happy when he asked me and my family to join forces to create a wine that could help gain this recognition around the world. He told me that his life devotion was putting Napa Valley in the wine map. And one wine that was very instrumental in helping him to achieve this recognition was Opus One, the joint venture he did with Baron Philippe de Rothschild. And so when he came to Chile, he had in mind the Opus One template, and he wanted to do a joint venture with the family to produce a wine that could be recognized over the years. And that was the mentality, that was the dream behind Seña, the wine we created together in 1995. Seña means the signature of the two families working together to them to showcase the best of the terroir of Chile. And we created the project in 1995. It was launched in 1997, and it has been a tremendous success since then. I mean, so much so that in the Berlin tasting, 9 years later, in 2004, Seña came together with Viñedo Chadwick atop of the first growth. So we proved, in only 9 years, we proved that the dream came a reality. We proved to the world that Seña should be considered amongst the first growths of the world.
Yeah. What a wonderful relationship you had. And you clearly bonded with, they call him Bob Mondavi rather than Robert, I think, generally, didn't they?
Yes. But,
what was he like?
He was a very generous man. He was in his 80s when he first came to Chile. I was in my early 30s. So I saw him as a great mentor. Of course, we were partners, equal partners, the two families, and they were very respectful on sort of putting our best knowledge on Chile and what he did in Napa. So it was a combination of trying to produce the best wine to challenge or to be in the company of the best wines that he would produce in Napa or anywhere or the best wines of the world. And that was the concept of Seña, trying to really create a unique wine from Chile. We felt it had to be a Bordeaux blend because Chile was based on Cabernet, and also we added Carmenere, which is this unique grape variety that came from Bordeaux but has become the Chilean signature. So because we wanted to have this Chilean identity, we didn't want to have another Bordeaux wine or Napa wine. It was creating a wine with a true Chilean personality. And I worked with that very closely with Tim, with Bob's son. Bob came every other year, but the man that really also worked hand-to-hand with me in searching the place, finding the right spot, the place in the Aconcagua Valley, and then doing the wine was Tim Mondavi, that came regularly many times a year. And our team also went to Napa to exchange ideas. And so the beauty is that being in the Northern Hemisphere, Mondavi and we in the Southern Hemisphere, we could travel, we could really work twice a year in really advancing the all the philosophy and all the practices.
Yes, being able to do two vintages in 1 year is very handy. Let's talk briefly about Carmenere, because it was once a Bordeaux grape, of course, and then it was, I believe, initially assumed to be Merlot in Chile in the early days. I think that's right, isn't it?
Carmenere was part of the classic blends from Bordeaux. It was part of Lafite, Mouton, all the top chateaus had Carmenere. But it was the most difficult grape variety to ripen because it's the last grape variety to ripen. First ripes the Merlot, then the Cabernet. And Cabernet needs a long season and more sun and more heat. And then in the 1890s, when Phylloxera struck the European vineyards and they were decimated and the vigneron had to replant, the grape variety that was never replanted was Carmenere because it was the most difficult grape variety to grow. But Don Maximiano and the other leading personalities from Chile in the mid-19th century had gone to Bordeaux before the Phylloxera struck, and they brought the cuttings. So in Chile, we had Carmenere alongside with Merlot, Cabernet Sauvignon, but as it disappeared from Bordeaux because it was never replanted, to any extent, the vigneron in Bordeaux replanted Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, sort of easy grape varieties for their climate. When we had Carmenere here, and no one knew that that was Carmenere because it had disappeared from the viticulture books. And it was Jean-Michel Boursicot, a French ampelographer, that came to Chile in 1994. And visiting the vineyards, he realized that this so-called Chilean Merlot, as we used to name it, happened to be Carmenere. At the beginning, it was a big scandal because we were afraid that exporting a Merlot that was not truly Merlot but was Carmenere could have been seen as a scandal of faking fake labels. So it was really an issue originally in Chile. But thereafter, the vineyards were separated. We started labeling Caminere for what it was. And it has a significant portion. I mean, it's a very important wine because it's a unique wine that give. And the other thing is that we have the climate to ripen Caminere because that's the key. It's a tricky grape variety. It has to be picked at the right time when you burn out the pita seeds and that you take away the green flavors and it becomes a beautiful coffee, a rich chocolate wine. But then you have to have very precise soils and the right climate for that.
I was going to say, it can be what in this country we would describe as a bit of a Marmite wine, which means you either love it or hate it. But I think actually that's got more to do with people like me having a bad experience with a rather green version, I suspect.
Yes, I think Caminere, you have to really understand where it is grown because I think it's tricky because it needs the right terroir. And if you don't have the right terroir or the right climate, it could be green and herbaceous. And I think very few people like green and herbaceousness profile, taste profile. So that's why the key is finding the right spot. Happily, in the Aconcagua Valley where we grow our Caminere, we have a very long, sunny summer time and we can wait the ripening of the Caminere and up to sort of April, mid-April, late April, and normally by then it's a really delicious juice and wine that is more chocolate, coffee, and tobacco. It gives beautiful complexity to the blends. And I think that's one of the keys of for example, we're talking about Seña. The Seña wine is a blend of Cabernet Sauvignon, Carmenere, as well as San Malbec. So it's a really Andean blend that is unique.
Yes, and very important for you in Chile too, to champion the role of Carmenere in that blend. Let's talk about a different icon wine you produce. And I'm looking back at my tasting notes here from the Dorchester last month. And I was particularly taken with Viñedos Chadwick, the 2014 vintage, and then much younger, much more tightly coiled still, but absolutely fabulous and fascinating, the 2020 vintage.
Well, Viñedos Chadwick was a project that started back in 1992 as a tribute to my father. It comes from the from our home estate in the Maipo Alto in the Puente Alto district, DO. And this platform it's a riverbank, 2 kilometers north of the Maipo River in the Piedmont at 700 meters above the sea level, is really known to be the cradle of Chile's finest Cabernet Sauvignon. My father had a property here in the 1940s that was called San José Tocornal, where he produced a wine called Fond de Cave. It was known to be really the best of Chile. And we've kept this property over the years. Now it's only 25 hectares, out of which 15 have been planted to Cabernet Sauvignon. And when my father died in 1993, he had allowed me to convert his beloved polo field into a vineyard. And then I decided to make a wine as a tribute to my father when he passed away. And that's the history, the background of Viñedos Chadwick, this polo field turned into a vineyard. And you were asking me about the effects of the Berlin tasting. If we didn't have any ratings in the before 2000, I think after the Berlin tasting, the critics started to come to Chile regularly. And the first to really give 100 points to a Chilean wine was James Suckling back in 2014, the wine we tasted at the Dorchester. And it has opened the door to being part of this fine wine club of the 100 points. And then Parker also gave us 100 points together with Tim Atkin and other critics from around the world for the vintage 2021. And so Viñedos Chadwick has been the icebreaker, the wine that has really helped transform and get the recognition for Chile being the first to receive this accolades from the world critics.
And you were brave to plough up a polo field in Chile, but it was worth it for the quality of the wines, I'm sure.
Well, I mean, I think my father should be very happy because his beloved polo field was turned into this, by destiny, into this unique vineyard that is giving so much credibility to Chile. It's been a milestone, really, for the Chilean wine industry.
It was worth it. There are plenty of other polo fields, I'm sure. Let's talk about destiny, because you have a new generation of your family getting involved in the business now. They're all female.
I have four daughters, indeed. And happily, I have managed to inspire three of them to join me in different aspects of the winery. One of them is living in London, Pepa. She's working with Patrick McGrath in Hatch Mansfield, being a sort of helping him and learning the intricacies of the fine wine world. No better place than London. And then two other, Maggie and Ali, are in Chile, working in looking after the brands, Chadwick and Senya, and communication, and also participating with Emily Falconer, our winemaker, our female winemaker, in really fine-tuning the wine and participating in the blending. So I would say I couldn't be happier to have my three daughters gaining the passion into continuing this story for the future.
And Emily Falconer has an incredible pedigree. She worked for you. She was also making wine at Chateau Margaux. She most recently, I think, went to, is it Carmen? I think. And then she's just come back to take the helm as technical director for Chadwick.
Yeah, well, we have, as you mentioned, she's a very, very talented winemaker, very nice lady. I'm very, very fond of her. And in fact, we had chosen her to be the successor for the future some 12 years ago. And he worked as the assistant to Francisco Bettig for several years. And then she took some years out of the company to gain more expertise and to run other companies in the winemaking. And I brought her back this past year. And she is really a wonderful lady, has a most sensible, a great palate. And we share the same principles of really fine winemaking, making wines that are truly from terroir wines. Finesse and elegance are the expressions that we most talk about. That's what we strive for. And she has that same philosophy. So I'm really sustainability or biodynamic farming, finesse, elegance, freshness. That's a style that we aim for our wines.
And you've worked closely with Francisco for a long time now, haven't you?
For several years, absolutely. She was trained by Francisco for many years. And so we were really delighted that she decided to come back now that she has gained more world international experience.
I was lucky enough to briefly visit the winery 7 years ago, and it looks a bit like a spaceship. It's very cool, but it does look almost space age, and that's because you've got a gravity-fed approach, haven't you?
Yeah. Well, when we wanted to really concentrate on the iconic wines, I asked a very dear friend, Samuel Claro, a very talented architect in Chile, to really build the winery, but we built it with a technical team. It was not just architecture. We invited Francisco Bettig and the winemaking team to really participate. So it was done from the winemaker's standpoint, trying to be as sustainable as we could. So everything is gravity-led when we take the grapes to the first floor and then they're crushed up atop of every tank and then fermented in the second, in the minus one, and then taken to the minus two for the barrel cellaring. Also, we have geothermal energy. That's the way we cool the air. We have a kilometer pipeline under the ground, so the air that comes into the winery, it's refreshed in summertime and warms a little bit in wintertime. We have solar panels for really for also for energy. And so all the elements of sustainability were taken care in the design of this winery, so much so that Jancis Robinson and Hugh Johnson wrote 4 pages about this winery in the 7th Encyclopedia of the World Atlas, claiming that this was a new world benchmark sustainable winery. So we were very fond of that article.
I'm sure. And of course, Jancis is probably the most prominent campaigner on the issue of bottle weight. So needlessly heavy bottles that almost hurt your arm to pick up. Have you moved on bottle weight? Because there are some pretty heavy bottles in the Chilean market, aren't there?
Yeah. We have never been tempted to go that way, to be honest. So we've never used heavy bottles. But we have indeed reduced over the years, to working together with the glass factory, to further reduce the weight. Although, as I said before, we were never into the heavy-handed, heavy bottle group of wineries that I think, you find some in the Chilean industry as well as elsewhere. But we have always, we are really keen on sustainability in the vineyard and in the wine, and of course in the packaging as well. So we try to be as sustainable as possible in using just the right bottle for the aging of the wine.
And that's, I guess, increasingly important. You must, like everyone else, be seeing the impact of climate change.
Absolutely. That's a key factor that is affecting around the world. In the case of Chile, I think the water availability is an issue. We've had more droughts over this past 20 years. So we've had to build more water reservoirs and really, really looked at how we irrigate. And I think the key has been to move to regenerative farming so that we can really help the water cycle and really treat the soil really think about the health of the soil for the long term. And that's where we're working with, really precision viticulture, the regenerative agriculture processes to really have a long-term sustainable farming and vineyard.
And I'm not sure how sustainable they are, but I remember when I came to visit your amazing, striking winery, the edge of the vines, there were these control towers, and they had, I think, armed guards on them, and they had binoculars. And I was assuming initially this was to protect your vines, but I'd never seen a vineyard protected like that before. I know they're valuable, but they can't be that valuable. And it turns out they were protecting something called green gold.
Yeah, it's true. We have a neighbor that has avocado plantings in the hillside. I don't know how much it's to protect them or to really oversee the whole operation, but everything you tell is true. And that has been a very rich agricultural development over the avocados that are being more and more received around the world. And the Aconcagua Valley, where there's no frost, has been particularly, a great spot for producing good avocados. So
that's your neighbor. Yeah, and they are delicious. I had plenty of avocados while I was in Chile. So we always end our interviews with a desert island wine, a favorite wine. If you are stuck on a desert island, you could only choose one wine, but you are allowed to choose your own because you have plenty of wine. And I know you're very close to your wines and you really enjoy those wines. So if you had to choose one wine on a desert island, what would it be?
It has to be one, David. Because
I'm afraid so. Sorry. Yep.
Well, I mean, the wine, I mean, there's nothing. I mean, I think for me, out of of my life, the wine that has been really, there's nothing more than when you can honor your father. So it's a family issue. I mean, for me, creating this wine vineyard of Chadwick from our home as a tribute to my father has been really the project that I'm most is a really cherished project that I'm so proud of, and I think it has been tremendously helpful to as the core wine of everything that we're trying to do in terms of getting the really recognition for Chile and for our portfolio of wines in the fine wine world. So out of my portfolio would be that. If you ask me from outside my portfolio, I think the wine I have the greatest respect is Chateau Margaux. That was my first visit in Bordeaux with Paul Pontalier, who was a dear friend. He was also a professor in Chile for some years. And so we always had a very nice relationship. And he was a great friend and a great inspiration. In fact, for me, Viñedo Chadwick somehow, that was my benchmark, or the wine I always saw it stylistically among the first cross of Bordeaux, that I would love to go there stylistically with Viñedo Chadwick.
Yes, so you've somehow managed to sneak two wines onto the island already. Yes, but there we are. No, but that's a lovely combination, the Chadwick and the Margaux. That's, that'll make a lovely evening do on your desert island. Thank you so much. It's a great pleasure to chat to you, Eduardo, and to see you again. Thanks so much for joining us on The Drinking Hour.
Thank you, David. Great pleasure to talk to you and look forward to seeing you again anytime in London. Thank you very much.
The Drinking Hour with David Kermode in partnership with Club Onologique, the world through the lens of wine and spirits.
We conclude as ever with some medal winners from the IWSC Hall of Fame, featuring Chile, of course. A gold medal winner first, Montgras. Intriga Maxima, Cabernet Sauvignon 2020, scored 95 points from a judging panel overseen by Master of Wine Alistair Cooper, featuring Draw Native MW of M&S fame, Harriet Tindall, a fine wine buyer, also an MW, and Martina Pocona of Jescott's Wine Merchants. And here's what they said. Exotic, ripe black fruits leap from the glass and follow to the palate, where they blend seamlessly with toasty oak and silky tannins. Perfumed, savoury notes add to the complexity of the long, layered finish. Here's a very strong silver for a wine made for one of Britain's major supermarkets, Morrison's, the best single vineyard Pinot Noir 2021. From Chile, of course. The very discerning judging panel, chaired by Ali Cooper, MW, also featured Master Sommelier Matteo Montoni, plus ex-BA buyer Kelly Stevenson, and South America expert Paolo Brammer. This one's from Aconcagua, and it's produced for Hatch Mansfield, who bring in the Errázuriz wines as well. And here's what they said, the judges: rich and juicy with red and black fruits layered over coffee, cloves, and ripe tannins. Here's another high-scoring Pinot Noir, Viñedas Veramonte Ritual Pinot Noir 2019. Silver with 92 points. The judge's tasting note here: ripe strawberries mingle with vanilla and cinnamon suggestions, while a note of earth lingers beneath. The palate is silky and satiating, rounding to a lengthy, complex finish. Semillon is, in my own opinion, one of the most exciting varieties in Chile at the moment. And here's a strong silver, Viña Morande, Semillon 2022, 92 points for this. The judges said lots of grass, nettle, and lemongrass aromas, with a palate of stone fruit, zesty citrus, and green apple. Boasts a particularly citrus-driven and persistent finish. And we talked earlier about Chile's signature variety. Here's a Carmenere to look out for from the Errázuriz stable. A bronze medal winner, this one. Vina Errázuriz Max Carmenere 2021. The judging panel described an unusual mix of nettles, saffron, and pepper aromas with black olives on the palate. There you go. That's it for this week. My thanks to Eduardo Chadwick. You can follow us at Food FM Radio and Club Onologique on Instagram and or Twitter. That's X these days. And I am Mr. Venusaurus on both of those platforms. Until next time, though, it's goodbye.
The Drinking Hour with David Kermode in partnership with Club Onologique, the world through the lens of wine and spirits.
To find out more about Food FM and our content, go to foodfmradio.com.